From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, and we're very thankful for every one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Sunday is the Christian observance of Pentecost. Sundown Thursday marks the start of the Baha'i observance of the Ascension of Baha'u'llah. It's also Memorial Day weekend. While this marks the traditional start of the summer vacation season, it's most important as a remembrance of the men and women in uniform who lost their lives in service to our country. The National Moment of Remembrance resolution was passed in the year 2000, which asked that at 3 p.m. local time, all Americans voluntarily and informally observe in their own way a moment of remembrance and respect, pausing from whatever they're doing for a moment of silence. That is such a very good thing to do. And this is also a good opportunity for us to recommit ourselves as citizens and as a nation to stand up for the living members of our armed forces by demanding appropriate health care for our veterans and ensuring that any military actions we undertake never, ever be taken lightly. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
The Pew Research Center says in the past 7 years, the Christian share of the population fell in the U.S. from 78.4% in 2007 to 70.6% today.
Last week on State of Belief, we looked at the ongoing growth in the number of Americans who say they are non-religious. The catalyst was a massive new report from the Pew Research Center titled America's Changing Religious Landscape. We spoke to a leading Pew researcher. We gave time to a scholar who is skeptical of any reports of declining religiosity. And we also have heard from a prominent sociologist who says that a lot of Americans are getting turned off to organized religion because of political rhetoric from the pulpit. Because this is such an important issue, and one that touches so many areas of American life, culturally, politically, socially, we're going to talk more about this changing landscape as we examine the implications for various groups in this country. For example, what does it mean for people of no religious faith? On this week's show, I'm looking forward to talking with James Croft, the new leader of outreach at the Ethical Society of St. Louis. I also want to reiterate how much we want to hear from you on this subject. Do you perceive the landscape as changing in your own daily life and the world around you? Please, please share your story with us so we can share it with our listeners. You'll find contact information at stateofbelief.com.
This is about the government coming in and saying, no, we're going to make you do this. And this is where I think we just need some space to say, let's have some tolerance, be a two-way street.
As more state legislatures weigh various versions of exclusionary so-called religious freedom restoration laws, Interfaith Alliance continues to promote one antidote to the encouragement of bias inherent in the language of many such bills, the We Serve Everyone Only campaign. Encouraging businesses and organizations to overtly express their commitment to inclusion. This week I'll talk with Mitchell Gold, co-founder of the Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams Furniture and Design Company, which has publicly and enthusiastically joined the Everyone Only campaign. But first,
Governor Bobby Jindal's executive order allowing businesses to uphold their religious beliefs, specifically dealing with same-sex customers.
Yeah, I think part of the First Amendment means that we allow individuals to obey their conscience, to obey their religious beliefs.
But Monroe pastor C. Welton Gaddy says this order is contradicting the First Amendment.
This is perhaps all about running for office and wanting to be the Christian candidate, but he doesn't have a right to do that when it costs the state of Louisiana its integrity in maintaining the Constitution.
This week, Louisiana governor and presumed presidential candidate Bobby Jindal signed an executive order designed to, quote, prevent the state from discriminating against persons or entities with deeply held religious beliefs that marriage is between one man and one woman. This after the Republican-dominated state legislature decided against a so-called Religious Freedom Restoration Act with a similar premise. Now, look, I'm fully aware that it may come across at times like I'm more focused on Jindal than is healthy. But living in Louisiana, I get to see this stuff up close. And I sincerely believe that it's less about the specific actions of a particularly odious executive and more about the kinds of strategies that are being tested to prepare for the Supreme Court's pending decision on marriage equality. So let's think of Louisiana as the canary in the coal mine of democracy. As I welcome my good friend, activist John Dennison, to State of Belief Studio. John, welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Welton. It's always great to be here. And I never tire of talking about Bobby Jindal, because America needs to learn what we in Louisiana have been learning about him for almost 8 years now.
Well, let's start by expanding a bit, if you will, on the recent events connected to Louisiana's version of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Well, let's start with the legislator who actually brought this odious bill to a session. And Louisiana, Welton, we are mired in red ink right now. We have a budget deficit projected to be $1.6 billion. This is a fiscal session. It's only supposed to deal with fiscal issues. However, each legislator in off-year fiscal sessions gets to file five non-budget-related bills. This Representative Mike Johnson from Bossier City, he represents the mindset that religion is here to marginalize people. It's only for those who subscribe to their brand of Christianity and not to what is in, you know, the general purpose for all of us here in our great state. He is rooted in the religious right. They anticipate the U.S. Supreme Court will, in just a matter of a few weeks, will legalize same-sex marriage across the board. And this is their half-fisted attempt to try to counter that among their faithful people.
Yeah. How does Louisiana's RFRA differ from the federal law that Bill Clinton signed back in 1993?
I mean, this is such a stretch. It's a solution in search of a problem. There is no problem here. He wanted to be able to have the state go in and say, look, if you have an objection to you baking a cake for this same-sex couple, that's fine. We understand that you have religious objections to that. Public accommodation laws don't matter here, apparently, which I find it ironic. He purports to be a constitutional attorney, yet he's just trampling all over our Constitution. That also cuts both ways because, as you know, Welton, Louisiana has a constitutional amendment that is now over a decade old that forbids same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. It defines it as marriage between a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. This is a state that has long trampled on the equal rights and denied the equal rights of the LGBT community, and it's continuing to do so. But the state RFRAs have not even been, the Louisiana passed in 2010, no one has even challenged it. No one has brought it up and tried to use it to their advantage. So these are all just words on paper by people who are trying to marginalize a large segment of our population.
John, it was just a couple of weeks ago that Jindal swore that he wouldn't cave to so-called corporate bullies in defying common sense and his own fiscal responsibilities and promising that protections for bias would become law in this state. Look, Jindal's approval is at 23%, so he's not playing to voters in Louisiana. He's not even playing to our economic interests. Who's playing the tune that he's dancing to?
Yeah. I don't know, Welton. You know, I really want to believe that he sincerely thinks that he can make a successful run for the presidential nomination of his party. But I've got to believe that there are just so many other machinations that have come into play here. You talk about a House of Cards episode. We could do one here in Louisiana just based on what Bobby Jindal has done to ignore his home state and to feed into his base on a national scale. He's made no secret that he's going to run for president. He will go to the ends of the earth to say he is protecting the religious freedom of Americans.
But he doesn't understand what religious freedom is.
His definition is just whatever he and his supporters want it to be, which takes somebody like me, a gay man, and it just says, you're marginalized. We love you. We love you, the sinner, but we hate the sin. They just cannot differentiate between what they see as something that they're doing to play to the base and how they're literally hurting people and families as they do it. This hurts people, Welton. This hurts me.
New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu quickly signed his own executive order stating that, quote, the city of New Orleans appropriately balances religious beliefs of all kinds with civil liberties, including freedom from discrimination. Why wouldn't that statement be enough at the state level?
And I want to add on to that because there's the following paragraph. I have the copy of his executive order here. He says, this executive order is an important symbolic affirmation that discrimination in any form will not be tolerated in New Orleans. We believe religious liberty and freedoms should be protected and discrimination prohibited. And we have passed our own laws to reflect that principle. New Orleans, by the way, is one of only two Louisiana cities that has non-discrimination citywide ordinances, Shreveport being the other one in North Louisiana, which forbids any kind of discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. We saw it in Arkansas. We're seeing increasingly in some states where we have legislators who are trying to tamp down what can be done on the local level. Well, I think Mitch Landrieu took that play from their playbook, and he says, look, Baton Rouge and Governor Jindal, this is my city. We do not discriminate. We welcome people regardless of their religious ties, of their sexual orientation, you name it. You are welcome here in Louisiana. And, of course, Mitch Landrieu also understands tourism is our largest industry in the state, and that is the biggest industry in New Orleans. It's interesting, well, you mentioned Bobby Jindal's approval rating. This is a solidly red state now. Many of the legislators are Republican, but they used to be Democrats. Many of them have switched in the last decade or so as they thought it would be politically expedient for them to do so and get them elected or reelected. But to be a governor in a red state and to have an approval rating lower in the state than President Obama, that's bad. This is what America needs to hear about Governor Bobby Jindal. He's been bad for Louisiana. He has not solved problems. He has created them. And he's done it all the way as he's been looking ahead to his run for the White House.
You know, I was in D.C. just a few days ago and was at a dinner table with several Republican leaders, one of whom who actually was a part of Jindal's campaigns for governor in both instances. And I asked, what's going on with this man? And this very high-ranking Republican leader said, we're all embarrassed by what he's doing. He's not playing fair with his Republican counterparts. And we don't know what's happened to him, but he is out of touch with the Republican Party and out of touch with America.
The pre-presidential primary polls are all showing if he does show up, he only shows up as a hash mark or maybe 1 or 2%.
Right.
I mean, he's the lowest of the low. Now, I do realize he's trying to gain traction in Iowa. We know that Iowa will vote conservatively, that there are a lot of evangelical Christians in Iowa that he's playing to. And in fact, the very day that he signed the executive order, Governor Jindal was running an ad for president, his first television ad in Iowa, professing to be the go-to guy for religious freedom. Now, how's that for coincidence?
Well, John, you have the trust of so many people in this state because of your long career in communications, an anchor on the news here in Monroe. As a longtime activist, as well as a respected communicator, talk about the efforts in Louisiana to protect the rights of everybody in the state in the face of Jindal's assault.
We have pushed Forum for Equality, the LGBT rights group that I've been a part of and chaired the foundation side of for the last 2 years. We've been pushing a non-discrimination bill. In fact, last year, and we brought it back up again this year, that we call LANA, the Louisiana Non-Discrimination Act. LANA not only outlaws it just in general, you cannot discriminate based on sexual orientation or gender identity or gender expression, but we also went through a number of Louisiana laws and we found almost 70 examples where there are non-discrimination policies that don't cover age, that don't cover sex, and even don't cover race here in the year 2015. Mm-hmm. So we had an omnibus bill that unfortunately wasn't brought up for a vote by the committee to the full House. And another bill last year that would have been a little bit narrower in scope also didn't make it out of committee. We also had that bill ready to go and was due to be heard the same day this week as House Bill 707, the Marriage and Conscience Act, but we decided to defer it. We thought it was important, and we talked with our other LGBT allies, particularly the ACLU here in Louisiana, which is a fine partner of Forum for Equality, and we agreed we needed to focus on this one really bad bill. And I think, Welton, this is a watershed moment for Louisiana's legislature. Now, I realize it's an election year. For those of you who don't know, in Louisiana, we'll elect our governor, a new governor, and a new legislature this fall. But for there to be 10 votes against this bill in committee and only two, and those 10 votes were bipartisan, speaks volumes in support of LGBT rights finally getting a decent seat at the table. And that's important at the legislature. Governor Jindal is not a hands-off governor. He has hand-chosen his House Speaker and his Senate President and committee leadership. Don't think that he is not pulling as many strings as he can in that body.
Mm-hmm. John Dennison is the chair of the Forum for Equality Foundation Executive Board. He's a longtime broadcast journalist, as I've said. He's also a community volunteer. John, I really appreciate you coming in today to visit with us again on State of Belief Radio and to enlighten our listeners about how things get done, how things get blocked, how things fail in the state of Louisiana. But it's not because of you. You are doing everything you can do, and we appreciate that.
Thank you, Welton. I appreciate it. Louisiana politics, it may be crazy, but it's never dull.
In 2012, it was my honor as president of Interfaith Alliance to honor businessman and activist Mitchell Gold with the President's Award at the Alliance's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards. Mitchell has devoted himself to promoting human rights and non-discrimination for as long as I've known him. And so it came as no surprise when his company, Mitchell Gold Bob Williams, enthusiastically joined the We Serve Everyone Only campaign. Now, characteristically, Mitchell went one step further. He's even bought advertisements promoting the company's endorsement of this initiative. So I am delighted to welcome Mitchell Gold back to State of Belief Radio. So, Mitchell, I am so glad that you're with us today. Thanks for being on again.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you again.
Why did you feel it was important to get into this campaign?
Well, I do think that the religious freedom bill, so-called religious freedom or liberty bills, are really despicable. And it's a hearkening back to the days when I was a teenager in the 1960s, and I remember the kind of discrimination that existed then against people of color, and also people who might have been minority religious group like Jews, or against women in certain instances. And a lot of these laws and thinking come from people's misguided, outdated religious teachings. And certainly, I feel like as time goes on, people should learn from their mistakes and do better by other people. And some folks just haven't learned. And putting this sign in the window is really us saying to people, enough is enough. Take your discriminatory religious beliefs. Unfortunately, legally, you're allowed to use them on Sunday morning in your church or synagogue or imam, whatever, but don't bring them into our store.
Hmm. Would it be fair to say, Mitchell, that for many, maybe even most business owners, the issue never came up until this latest controversy? I mean, I don't get the impression that most business leaders were just gritting their teeth, feeling like their rights were being trampled, and they were waiting to be rescued by a law under the guise of religious freedom.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. I think this is purely political. This is a perfect instance of people using religiosity to gain their political advantage. Ted Cruz, I think, is one of the kings of this, that he just keeps spouting this crazy stuff. And Jeb Bush now all of a sudden is becoming far more anti-gay than he has come across in the last few years. But they feel that they need to do this to stoke the fire with their political base.
Mm-hmm. What toll does it take on our civic society when culture war issues are enshrined in state-level laws? Because I see it as a really irresponsible way of pitting one side against the other for short-term political gain.
Well, I think it is incredibly irresponsible. I agree with you. And, you know, I think the worst part of this is when these subjects become out in the open and debatable. Let's just think for a minute about a 14 or 15-year-old kid who's struggling to deal with their same-sex orientation, who's brought up in an environment that they're taught that it's a sin and an abomination to be gay. And now they have their parents talking about this at the dinner table. And, you know, these poor closeted kids are going through such turmoil, such depression, such struggle. And now they have to hear their parents talk about it in a denigrating way. This is the reason why young kids become so depressed and even suicidal and, unfortunately, even do commit suicide. So, you know, I once had dinner with Maggie Gallagher, and I made it clear to her that her efforts were the kinds of things that brought dinner table conversations that make kids 14 and adults that are 40 years old who are struggling really depressed and in enormous conflict with their parents' beliefs.
Mitchell, the religious liberty argument is a relatively recent strategy. Do you see the tactics that we're seeing now as a setback in an area that has seen so much progress, or is it just a temporary distraction?
Well, I think it's the next wave of strategy of people who are desperately holding on to the Ozzie and Harriet days. Hmm. These are folks that are just completely frazzled that now gay people can be married in 30-some-odd states now. And this is their last-ditch effort. Now, I will say I'm very disappointed in the LGBT advocacy groups and other advocacy groups who have not broken the foundation of religion-based bigotry, who have not broken the foundation of people using their outdated and misguided religious teachings to discriminate against other people. There are too many people who are afraid to talk about religion, to say to somebody else, I think your thinking is wrong, and here's why I think it's wrong. I don't know if you've read Reverend David Gushee's most recent book.
Mm-hmm.
He's an evangelical minister and ethics professor at, I think it's Mercer University in Atlanta.
Yes.
Who was very much against gay people being able to be married. He was a believer that gay people were sinners. And over years, he's come to change his thinking once he started to critically, and I believe that our Creator gave us a mind to learn more and think critically, but once he started to think more critically about what the Bible does and doesn't say, once he started to really understand the harm that was being caused to young people especially, he started to research more, and he came to the conclusion that, you know what, the Bible really doesn't say that loving gay couples shouldn't be married. Mm-hmm. Scripture really doesn't mean that people who are born with the same-sex orientation and are good, productive, wonderful people, that they should be second-class citizens, that they should be told that they're broken. So while I think this is a last-ditch effort by certain people who are politically motivated or who are just unfortunately mean-spirited or ignorant, there's a whole other wave of really wonderful people who are really changing their minds.
Mm-hmm. Mitchell, what angers you the most about the use of religious rhetoric to harm LGBT persons?
What angers me the most
uh-huh.
is because as I sit here right now, a chill runs through my body, and I remember when I was 14 and 15 and 16 years old, how absolutely afraid I was, how vulnerable I was, how far too many nights I cried myself to sleep because I thought that God didn't love me, that I was broken. And it is irresponsible and despicable that parents and clergy put this upon young, vulnerable, innocent kids that even today, as we sit here, are still taking their own lives. There is a young, now 14-year-old, in my community who came to see me a year ago, and he told me that he got a hold of my book, Crisis, mm-hmm. that saved his life. That he had tried to commit suicide on several occasions. He was cutting himself. But after reading that, he was determined that he was going to live and be happy. And when I spoke to this 13-year-old, now 14-year-old, innocent, sweet, beautifully smiled boy, and thought to myself that this kid had to go through that kind of torture alone. Because when you're 14 or 15 and you're going through this and your parents are against you, you don't have anybody to talk to.
Right.
And you can't go to your church and talk to your clergy or to your synagogue if it's an Orthodox Jewish denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just an outrage that in our civilized society, people are still clinging to these, as I say, outdated, misguided, and ill-informed religious teachings.
Mitchell, talk about some of the recent work that your foundation, Faith in America, is doing. Where are your current priorities there?
Well, we've spent a lot of time talking to the news media, a lot behind the scenes, getting them to understand the real problem, getting them not to just ask somebody, oh, are you for or against gay marriage? And if you notice when news media ask that question, whenever somebody answers it, they'll say deeply held religious beliefs, and then they go on to the next question.
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten them not to ask the question so lightly and to understand more deeply that anti-gay sentiment, how it affects young people. You know, Wolf Blitzer several months ago said to me that he just couldn't believe how many transgender people under 25 years old, 40% of transgenders under 25 years old, have tried to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Getting news people to see how horrible this is and how, even though you don't see it that much in the public eye, how there's this undercurrent of real depression and suicidal tendencies amongst the LGBT community. So getting them to take it a little bit more seriously. We're working now to get the news media really to think twice about when the Pope comes on his visit and to not just let it be some flowers and roses visit. I mean, to really start to ask clergy who are out as his spokespeople to try to get questions out in the public to the Pope. You know, where does he really stand? What is he really going to do? The reality is he has said certain things like, oh, who am I to judge? But then he's turned around and said very judgmental things.
Mm-hmm.
So working with the media has been a very big priority. Another big priority is working with school counselors. High school counselors play a pivotal role in a lot of these young people. And we have a particular instance of a young gal in this community, a small southern community, who came out as a lesbian, and her counselor was anything but helpful, was in fact saying things like, well, you know, that's a sinful lifestyle. And you know, getting counselors to really understand what they're saying and the impact that that has on a kid and that they should be a safe refuge. The other big thing is we've spent the last several years really trying to get the LGBT advocacy organizations to understand the role that bad religion plays in the legislation. This is why we have this kind of legislation and getting them to step up their game. And we have seen and are going to continue to see organizations like GLAAD and the Human Rights Campaign and Campus Pride really stepping forward a lot more.
Mitchell Gold is co-founder of Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams, a longtime activist for LGBT rights. Mitchell recently joined in the Interfaith Alliance anti-discrimination campaign called We Serve Everyone Only, encouraging businesses to post signs that say just that as a way of opposing the religious liberty loophole in legislation pending in several states that would create protections for discrimination. In the next few weeks, the Alliance will be mailing out over 20,000 of these signs to supporters, but you don't have to wait. You can print out a We Serve Everyone Only sign at www.everyone-only.org. And we encourage you to post a picture of your sign once it's up. We want to put it on social media. Use the hashtag Everyone Only.
Do we have time for me to tell you one more thing about the campaign and how it's affected our business?
Do it.
So one of the things I didn't realize is we actually have some employees who are uncomfortable with that sign going up. And we had one in particular who told the manager that she didn't want to be associated with that campaign. And it opened up an opportunity for me personally to talk with her about it. And, you know, one of the things I had to say to her was, well, let me ask you this. If a gay couple comes in and a straight couple come in, are you going to walk towards one and not the other? If a gay couple comes in, are you not going to help them make their house a home, especially if they're talking about they're engaged, they're getting married, or they already are married? And it really forced a great conversation with her. And I'm, you know, really happy to say that she's really moved the ball much further down the court than she was before. And the other thing I want to tell you is that we, you know, have the sign posted on our doors and in our windows. And it is interesting how people are coming by and taking a selfie with themselves and that picture, coming in and telling us how much they like it. So I continue to think that being open-minded and fair-minded and educated about other people is good for business.
Thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The latest Pew Research Center poll, titled America's Changing Religious Landscape, Christians Decline Sharply as Share of Population, Unaffiliated, and Other Faiths Continue to Grow, made headlines and spurred interesting discussion on last week's State of Belief. As we continue this vitally important conversation, I'm joined now by James Croft, the new leader for outreach at the Ethical Society of St. Louis. James, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be on the air with you, Welton.
How is this issue resonating in the humanist community?
I think that there is strong interest in the report among the humanist community for obvious reasons. It's a report that suggests that there's a lot of opportunity to recruit many more humanists. There are many, many people out there who are turning away from traditional religions and don't find them to be fulfilling in their lives. And we think, many of us, that we have an alternative that might be interesting to them. And particularly in ethical culture societies around the country, which are humanist communities, we want to try and reach out to these new religious nuns to see if what we're doing is interesting to them and fulfill some needs that they have. So we're interested to read the report and excited about it.
Are the conversations that you're having around these issues, both in terms of what it means in our society at large and in terms of the kind of outreach you ought to be engaged in to respond to these changes?
Yes, I think we have discussions at both of those levels. Firstly, for society at large, it is a significant and very fast-moving shift in the demographics of the United States, which is a very religious country, particularly for one of its level of development and wealth. It's unlike the United Kingdom, where I grew up. You can probably tell from my accent that I'm a Londoner by birth. And in the UK, you sort of assume that people are not religious. And if people express religious faith, it's a little unusual. It's not a bad thing, but it's something that you don't hear absolutely every day. But when I moved to the United States, I remember realizing how very religious it is and how deeply a particular brand of conservative religion has become powerful and embedded in the political process. And these shifts seem to suggest that many younger people and increasingly older people are sort of tired of the influence of right-wing religion and are associating religion with a certain set of regressive values, and they don't hold those values themselves, and so they're moving away in their own minds from identification in religion. And I think that's really interesting for the US as a whole, because it suggests by implication a shift towards what I view as a more humane, even perhaps more humanistic set of cultural values, which is beginning to prevail among the younger generation. And I'm really excited to see that.
James, how common is the feeling that people of no faith continue to be treated as second-class citizens?
That's a difficult one. I've certainly experienced myself, and I know community members at the Ethical Society of St. Louis have experienced prejudice for not being traditionally religious. Even though our members attend what is essentially a congregation, a humanist congregation, they do sometimes have to have difficult discussions with family members and friends about what they believe and what they don't believe. And we at the Ethical Society believe that our commitment is to each other and to the community of people around us and in the whole world, rather than to any divinity. And that does make us an unusual congregation in the St. Louis area. In Missouri, we're the only ethical society, and it sometimes does lead to people feeling a little bit left out of the local and national conversation. And certainly, if you look further afield, there are examples of genuine discrimination against non-religious people. I think that that's beginning to change, though. And I think it's beginning to change not just because the religious demographics of the United States are changing, but also because of the efforts of some younger humanist activists, people like Chris Stedman, who you've had on the show before, who's a good friend of mine, and others who are really putting forward a positive vision of what life without traditional religion can look like, and are stressing the shared values that humanists and many religious people have. And I think that message is starting to get through to people. I know that in my work after what happened in Ferguson here in St. Louis, working alongside many clergy from many different faiths, it's been really wonderful to see the relationships that we've been able to develop and how openly they've welcomed humanist participation in the protests and the rallies and the organizing that we've been doing down here. We have had nothing but the greatest respect from our religious neighbors here in St. Louis. And I think that the more that we promote a positive values-based message of humanism, the more that we will gain acceptance in American society.
Often, and especially when talking with people about polls such as the Pew poll, it's almost as if the two people that are talking, whoever I'm talking with, we're standing there talking and we talk about humanists, but it's almost as if humanists can't speak for themselves. We have to talk about them, and they don't have a right to be in the conversation. They have a right to be talked about. And I'm glad to hear you say that people are being respectful and that you are feeling pulled into the social crises of our time as a major influence and contributor to help.
Yeah, it's been a really amazing experience to be in St. Louis over the past year, given everything that's happening. And it has been an opportunity to ask the question, what does the humanist voice sound like when dealing with issues of racial injustice and police brutality? And I think I perhaps am slightly different in my perspective on this than some humanists, in the sense that, yes, I believe we deserve a place at the table and deserve to be represented in these cultural discussions. But I think that we have to take responsibility for coming up with something very compelling to say before we can really expect people to reach out to us to say something. And previously, I'm not sure that the voice of American humanism has been as passionate on issues like racial injustice and poverty and the environment, many of the major issues that face us now, as we could have been. And I've found people are very receptive to the message, very receptive to us getting involved in clergy coalitions and things like that. As long as we reach out to them and say, hey, we're here, we have a community in town, we care about these issues, can we have a place at the table? And I have been very unashamed about going out there and making the case for humanist participation. And usually it's received very, very positively. And if there are other humanists listening to this, or people who just consider themselves not religious, my message would be, get involved, extend the hand first, and you might be surprised by how welcoming people are. There's a lot of shared values out there.
I want to stay with that for just a second, James, because you know the mythology and the incredibly uninformed opinion that humanists and atheists don't have any morals because they're not theists. Well, we all know better than that. When you show up at a place like Ferguson and you are there to help and you have a message also to share, what do you say to the other religious leaders? What is your message that goes along with their messages?
All people matter. And ethical culture, which is the movement which ethical societies like the one I work at were founded to represent, is founded on the basic belief in the equal dignity and worth of every person. And our founder, Felix Adler, who is the son of a rabbi and a deeply philosophically engaged person, after much deep philosophical thought and study, felt he couldn't subscribe any longer to traditional theistic beliefs, traditional belief in God, but that he felt a need to absolutely uphold the dignity and worth of people. And so he went on a big philosophical excursion to try and find a way to ground that dignity outside of a theistic framework and started to build these communities, congregations all around the country, to uphold human worth and dignity without reference to theism. Not to say that you can't join an ethical society if you believe in God. We have members who believe in God. It's supposed to be a common ground where everybody can meet. But what we focus on is how do we help people have the best possible lives that they can have in this one life that we all know that we have. The first principle of ethical societies, the founding principle, is that morality can be derived without theism, without reference to a god. And he felt that that was an extraordinarily important message for society to hear. So when I go and work with my clergy colleagues, who I love, by the way, I have been so inspired by the Christian preachers and rabbis and imams who I've met through the small amount of work that we've been able to do in Ferguson. When I go and meet with them, what I try and do is focus the discussion on the people. Because sometimes, even with my liberal theologian friends, my liberal clergy friends who are wonderful people, the discussion can become about Jesus or it can become about religious abstractions. And I think that we should be able to talk about Michael Brown just because his life matters as much as everybody else's. So what I try and do is bring the discussion back to the people who are involved and affected and assert that they matter and that we do what we do because they matter.
You know, James, our listeners know that recently I spent several days in Sri Lanka trying to negotiate some religious tensions among religions there. And what I was most surprised about was that over and over and over, I heard people from different religions say, why don't we come together around the dignity and worth of humankind? Let's begin there and let whatever religion we have come in supportive of that, but giving more attention to the importance of humankind, and then go to our various doctrines or rituals or whatever. I was amazed and pleased.
Yeah, that's an amazing shift. And I think that I've often seen shifts like that in particularly liberal religious thought. I was amazed when the Dalai Lama released a book about secular ethics not too long ago that read to my humanist mind as a sort of humanist manifesto in a way, focusing on the dignity and worth of people before theological considerations. I find that sort of discussion very exciting because my belief, my personal ethical religious, call it what you will, belief, is that the most important thing, the center of ethics, is the worth of the person. And if you start there, it's very difficult to go wrong anywhere else down the line. But if you start anywhere else, it is possible to end up with an ethical framework that's really disturbing. And I think that it's not so unusual that many religions can come to a place where they really respect human worth and dignity, and that there are messages of respect for human worth in every great religious tradition, because from our perspective, all religions were created to fulfill deep human needs, like the need for meaning and community and assistance in living a good life. And they're based around the desire to uphold what is good in people very often. And that lifting up that element in religious traditions is a really powerful thing.
James, tell our listeners how they can get more information if they desire to do so, information on what you're doing in St. Louis and what you want to say about the whole humanist movement.
So I am currently a leader in training at the Ethical Society of St. Louis, and just last week, on Thursday actually, my community elected to offer me the position of outreach leader, so it's super exciting. I should be starting in August as a real Ethical Society leader. And the website for the Ethical Society of St. Louis is ethicalstl.org. And if you are not in or around St. Louis, there might be an ethical society near you. And to find one, you can just go to the website of the American Ethical Union, which is the sort of umbrella organization which unites all ethical societies and attempts to promote them throughout the country. And their website is aeu.org.
James Croft is the new leader for outreach at the Ethical Society of St. Louis. You are a wonderful spokesperson for your message and for the work that you and your colleagues are doing. He starts that position in August. James, I want to thank you for reaching out after hearing our coverage last week, and thank you so much for what you've brought to us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Walton. It was a pleasure.
Now, before we go, on Friday, Ireland participated in a national referendum on marriage equality. Ireland. There have been news reports of Irish citizens living abroad, traveling back to the Emerald Isle just to take part in this vote, which requires a voter's physical presence. Polling in advance of Friday's vote indicated support for equality running as high as 73%, although these surveys exclude undecided voters. With everyone factored in, though, the latest survey showed support for in the high 50s. Now look, we're taping this show on Friday, so you may well know the outcome of that election before we do. Still, as the conversation on State of Belief continues about research showing a continued secularization of Americans, one might be tempted to interpret the strong polling in advance of the vote as another sign of that trend. But I want to highlight one aspect of pre-referendum rhetoric that caught my eye. The Archbishop of Dublin, along with hierarchy members under him, has urged the faithful to oppose the change. Well, there's no surprise there, since the teaching of the Catholic Church remains one man, one woman. But get this. In a column written for a secular newspaper, the Archbishop stated, and I'm quoting, "As a bishop, I have strong views on marriage based on my religious convictions. I have, however, no wish to stuff my religious views down other people's throats." Huh. Now, granted, he went on to argue forcefully against equality. But there is something refreshing about even that compared to what we've been unfortunately becoming accustomed to in the United States. If it can happen in a country with such a deeply religious history as Ireland, why in the world not here? It's something to consider as we wait for the referendum results. the first such national vote of any nation, and particularly noteworthy in the last Western European country, to decriminalize homosexuality just over 20 years ago. The church will endure. The institution of marriage will endure. Both will endure if the majority votes yes to equality. And if respectful rhetoric continues among those who disagree, both the church and the state will be stronger for it. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief this past week, I want to say a very sincere thank you. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. If you like today's show, if you find value in what you're hearing from us, then I urge you to join our other generous supporters and do it today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories you find compelling with your friends. They need to hear this too. We really need you. You're crucial to helping spread the word. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us again next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.